Future Proof Extra
with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, do you think that evolution is a flawless march towards perfection? Well, if so, think again, because our DNA is riddled with quirks, flaws and mysteries that defy the idea of a perfect design. Professor Lawrence Hurst is a professor of evolutionary genetics at the University of Bath. He's been writing about this in his new book, The Evolution of Imperfection. Welcome to the programme, Lawrence. It's funny, when we look at, you know, the human species, we have so well adapted to this environment around us over many millions of years of evolution. But at the same time, I've always wondered why we have a lot of the things that are not useful in our genome. And I suppose that's part of what you're looking at in this book.
It certainly is part of it, but it's not that only. Humans hold unwanted records, you might say, for our imperfections. So, for example, all organisms mutate, by which we mean when mum and dad make a baby, there are changes in the DNA and genetic diseases come about because of so-called mutations. We happen to have the record for the number of mutations that any organism has. The normal thing, so to speak, we've got one of the highest rates going, which is weird. The other record that we hold, again, unwanted, is with new genetics, we can now go in and look at very early human embryos, so actually just a fertilized egg, or an egg which is yet to be fertilized. And what we find is that of the order of 50%, half of them or so, are so genetically bad, actually they have the wrong number of chromosomes, that they're so genetically bad that they go nowhere. So they get fertilized and they die almost straight away.
Half?
Those that survive account for quite a high proportion for our stupidly high miscarriage rate. So in humans, the miscarriage rate, let's say, recognized pregnancy at about week six. Just about everybody who wants to get pregnant knows you don't tell anybody till week 12 because our miscarriage rate is very high. It's about 15 to 20%. If you're an older mother, that goes up to 65%. Mm. So genetically, we're really bad at reproducing. We've got a very high number of genetic diseases. We're very poor at making babies. And then you go and look at our DNA, as you're alluding to. So if you look at the DNA as something lovely, like a bacteria or something like that, so in your gut at the moment, there's a couple of trillion bacteria. We can sequence the DNA of any of those. And what you find is, on the average, about 85% of the sequence of that DNA is doing what DNA is supposed to do. It makes RNA, which makes protein. And the other 15% is doing our sort of switches for the bits, the important bits. So remember that 85% number. Now you go to our DNA, and you ask, what is our DNA? What's that proportion that is actually making protein? And that's 1%.
What?
It's just 1%.
1% of our DNA is making protein, which is, as far as we know, the whole purpose of DNA.
The whole purpose of DNA. You read your textbooks. It says DNA makes RNA makes protein. Now, there is some control-y stuff, and we do also have some DNA that just makes RNA that doesn't make protein. But when we try and look at it and ask the question, how much of this looks as though it's functional? And by looking at how these things evolve, you can get ideas as to how much is functional. In our DNA, we think it's less than 10%. Best estimates, about 8%, 9% is functional.
But what is the rest then? Like a evolutionary vestigial DNA?
It is. So we use the word junk because what junk actually means, you know, you've got something. Imagine you had to pay to get rid of stuff and take it off to landfill, for example. Mm. Well, there's stuff that you wouldn't do that with because it's just not worthwhile getting rid of it. And our DNA is sort of full of stuff like that, the stuff you put in the garage or in the loft. Not for a rainy day, just because you can't get rid of it. And so more than half of our DNA is the dead and decaying remains of old viruses or old what we call jumping genes or transposable elements. So things like HIV have an unusual property. They can insert back into our DNA. And when they do that, they become endogenous retroviruses as opposed to just a retrovirus. So retro means it goes backwards. It goes from RNA back into DNA. And about 8% of our DNA is the old dead and decaying remains of things like HIV.
Sorry, are you telling me that of my beautiful 23 chromosomes, a large chunk of that actually belonged to viruses in the past, and now it's just been reproduced because when a sperm and an egg come together, take a copy of this gene, so a virus might have infected some great ancestor, inserted itself in its DNA, and I have this dirty old copy of their virus DNA in my body?
You do, and it is decaying, typically. Some of them get sort of recruited through to useful functions. Some of them,
really?
I look at it, actually. Yeah, how some of this stuff then ends up being recruited. But basically, we have a large amount of machinery to try and also shut all of this stuff down. We really don't want it in there, so we want to try and stop it doing anything. So it just ends up as sort of dead and decaying DNA fossils sitting there in your DNA, not doing very much. So the mystery is, why have we got huge amounts of our DNA like that? But I said, if you go and look at our lovely laboratory yeast or bacteria, it's nearly all functional. It's all there to do a good reason. How can we explain these weirdnesses? And that's really what the book's about.
Yeah, like, I mean, given how, you know, how fatal a lot of genetic things can be, just a small change in our DNA and instantly fatal, right? How is it possible that we have all of this junk that hasn't just been evolved out of us? What is the reason that we have all of this wasteful DNA? Why is it not more efficient to have snipped this out of my my 23 chromosomes and gotten rid of it over the millions of years of evolution that eventually turned into the perfection of me?
Yeah, absolutely. So what you're doing is you're assuming that the evolutionary process is a process that can only improve and improve and improve. And it's very rational to think that because, you know, we have the term like the survival of the fittest. So the better gives way to the even better and so on and so forth. Mm. And that's really sort of hard boiled into our conventional understanding of evolution. So if you think about, if I ask you to think about an image of evolution, or just put it into Google Image Search, your listeners can do it. Put evolution into Google Image Search. What comes back is something like the march of progress. You know that image of the knuckle walking chimp, and then eventually we rise up at the end, and so on and so forth. And it builds in this idea that Hamlet put it, we are the paragon of animals, that Shakespeare's Hamlet, that somehow we are the best evolution can produce. And the process by which it does it is entirely progressive. Now, what's happened in the last 30 years or so is that we've realized that that isn't actually all there is to evolution. Now, certainly if you had a mutation or one of these transposons insert somewhere and it's lethal and it kills you, well, it's going nowhere. Yeah, it comes in and the individual that dies, and so that bit of DNA goes out as well. But what we're really thinking about when we think about this stuff is not stuff that's really harmful. We're thinking about stuff that's a little bit harmful.
Hmm.
So it's inserted into some bit of DNA. It costs you a little bit to make a copy of it. Not massive, just a tiny little bit. And how are we going to think about mutations that only affect us a tiny little bit? And this is where a body of theory, which I don't think is particularly well known at all, but it's actually the most important body of evolutionary theory over the last 50 years or so. It was developed by a Japanese woman called Tomoko Ota. And her insights are just so profound. There isn't a Nobel Prize in evolutionary biology, but is the thing called the Crawford Prize. And she won the Crawford Prize for this. So it's sort of the Nobel Prize for evolutionary biology.
Right.
And what she said is we're thinking about this problem all wrong. That what you have to think about is not a mutation that comes in and kills you. That's fine. We know what's going to happen to those. But think about them that they're slightly harmful. She said, this is really brilliant. She said you have to think about these more like particles of dust. So you know that occasion when, you know, the sunlight is coming through your room and you can see particles of dust.
Yes.
We've all been there. And they can go up in a little bit and they can go down a little bit and they just sort of wobble about. Yeah, they sort of wiffle-waffle about. And she said that actually if you think about slightly harmful mutations, they're actually like particles of dust. They could go up in frequency just because of chance and they can go down in frequency because of chance. Now, because they're a little bit harmful, on the average, they're going to go down in frequency. So a mutation comes in, it's lethal, it goes down in frequency. She said, well, if it's slightly harmful, it doesn't actually necessarily have to go down in frequency. Mm. It could wiffle-waffle about a bit. And then her really key insight, and this is what really unifies things, is she said, actually, now think about that process in a room that has got a tall ceiling versus a short, small ceiling. So one is a species with a small population, one is a species with a large population. And so the particle of dust comes in. It's a new mutation, that's what we're thinking about. Comes in close to the floor, but it can whiffle-waffle about. It can go up, it can go down, just as any particle of dust can be. And what she notices is if you're in a small population, that slightly harmful particle of dust can actually get to the ceiling. Now, in evolutionary terms, what that means is that you've got a slightly harmful mutation which came in, and it hasn't been eliminated by selection.
Mm.
It's got to the point where it's actually now a difference between us and chimps, for example. And so her grand prediction then is that because of this process being more important in small populations than large populations, the particles of dust can go from near the floor to the ceiling if the room is very short, but it's very unlikely to do it if it's a very large room, is that species without many members in them, that's a short sort of a small ceilinged room, as it were, are more vulnerable to this sort of process.
Yeah.
So when we get this transposable element, this jumping gene, it inserts into our DNA and it has very little effect on us. That's like one of these dust particles. It can go up in frequency, not because it is good for us, just simply because selection is inefficient.
Right.
So yes, this bloating of DNA is particular to species with small population sizes.
And what does that mean in terms of our own genomes? Does that mean that we end up tolerating propagating more susceptibility to cancer or sickle cell disease or lower immune system? Is that what that means?
Absolutely. There's another prediction which says that actually if you're in a small population, mutations that change your mutation rate are going to behave like this as well. So species with small populations will actually have a higher mutation rate than species with large populations. And that we can now test. We've been able to test that in the last 5 or so years because we can now sequence mum, dad, offspring for lots and lots of species. And it's absolutely right. So the reason we have lots of genetic diseases is in no small part because we have a very high mutation rate. And we have a high mutation rate, we think, simply because we've got a small population size, we can't stop our mutation rate going up a little bit.
Hmm.
But if you look at that bacteria in your gut, for example, you will see that its mutation rate, controlling for the amount of DNA it has, is 3 orders of magnitude lower than ours.
Right.
So it's massively lower. So between 5 and 10% of us, we estimate, have a, quote, rare genetic disease. And a rare genetic disease means one that affects less than 1 in 2,000 of the population. We get more of them, and we're not very good at getting rid of them either.
Yeah, you make it sound like we're at the bottom of the evolutionary fitness scale. But this is Lawrence Hurst. He's Professor of Evolutionary Genetics at the University of Bath and the author of The Evolution of Imperfection.
Future Proof Extra.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
On News Talk.